Hi, and welcome to Cha Chat. I'm Eric Fosak, librarian over at Carlson Health Sciences Library at UC Davis. And today we have a very special episode where we're talking about tea culture, but maybe outside of what we normally think of as a tea culture. We think of the British, we think of China, we think of Japan. But how often do you think of the Carpathian Mountains? Well, today hopefully you will. Joining me is Dr. Nina Fontana, an ecologist that has conducted research in the Carpathian Mountains in Ukraine and is currently a postdoc at UC Davis with the Native American Studies Department studying cultural burning. And also Nadja Tarnowski, a singer who has done folk song collecting in Ukraine and most recently a Fulbright Award. It is also a privilege that Nadja has allowed us to use some of that music for this podcast. So, you know, I'm not going to do you any service. What I really want to do is ask you about yourselves. And the question I always like to start off with is, what is your personal and professional relationship with tea? So as an introduction, how have you been involved in tea personally, in your personal life and your professional life? And Nina, I'll start with you, and then we'll pass it over to Nadja, if that's all right.
Yeah, I guess my personal connection with tea probably started out as a little kid, and I associate tea as medicine. You know, when I was sick, my mom had very specific ways of making tea and treating the common cold or flus even. And as I've grown up, I've realized, oh man, tea's delicious. It's not just medicine. And I've been able to explore, yeah, like every morning I like to drink tea, for example. And then professionally, a lot of teas are plant-based. And so my job as an ecologist lets me interface and be with plants a lot of the time. And so in my dissertation research, I spent a lot of time drinking tea with people, but also making tea and looking at plants.
Yeah, and for me, actually very similar. You can tell that Nina and I both have Ukrainian roots. Tea did start out as medicine. It's like, oh, you're sick. Oh, you need tea. And it's like, that's the thing. But really, tea is a great connector among people. There's that great book, Three Cups of Tea. It's just like after you have three cups of tea with somebody, you're more than friends. Like there's this deep connection. There's something to that. And so that's on the personal, on the professional level, tea as a singer, I call that tea is like the rosin on my bow. You know, you have certain kinds of teas that are really helpful for you when you sing. And so if I'm in the recording studio, there's specific kinds of teas with specific kinds of honeys that, that I'm almost, I always make sure that I have with me because it just makes the process so much easier. And, so it's something that I make sure that I have with me almost always. Like the cabinet in the house is never without tea for a variety of purposes.
I think I should also preface this because this podcast, the Global Tea Initiative, which is what this podcast is born out of, doesn't just deal with tea as a concept of Camellia sinensis, the plant, but we do look at tea very broadly as infusions, which I believe will be a big part of our conversation today because as we discuss Ukrainian tea culture, Camellia sinensis may be drunk, but I think there's a much larger variety of infusions that are consumed. So starting with that, what would you normally drink as a tea, either as medicine or socially in the Carpathian Mountains?
Nina, you want to go first?
I think, so there's I'd say multiple different tea cultures in many different countries, not just Ukraine. But in the Carpathian Mountains, you know, you can find different types of tea in local stores or even in little markets like farmers markets. And they'll have specific plants in there that will advertise for, you know, the common cold or digestive issues or, you know, lots of vitamins or whatever else. But then I think the second culture of tea happens at home, which is more personal and definitely more individualized because it's based on gathering practices. So just to contextualize a little bit about the Carpathian Mountains themselves, it is the second largest tract of mountains in Europe. And there are a lot of different ethnographic groups of folks that live in these mountains. And Nadia and I had the honor of living and visiting and working with Hutzuls. And Hutzuls are an ethnographic group of folks that inhabit this particular part of the Carpathian Mountains. And so they are very much connected to their environment, whether it's the forest or the rivers or the fields or their gardens. And so their teas come from those particular environments. And so when you go into a Hutzul home, you will see different teas being used that are different from maybe the teas you see in those markets, which still doesn't answer your question of what's in them. Nadia, you can...
Yeah, I mean, the one, and it's like if you're looking for something that's really odd, so I had a cold while I was in the Carpathians, and so they're like, you need to go to the market, you need to go get a black radish. And I was like, okay. And so what they said to do was to cut the top of the black radish out and hollow it out so that it'd be like a cup. And then coat the black radish with honey and then let it, and then put like the top of it back on. So it was just like a hollowed out black radish with the top of the black radish out and just let it sit on the counter. Like you actually have to sit it in a cup because, you know, it would fall over. Let it sit overnight and then the honey would kind of like, you know, pull out the juices of the black radish. And then in the morning, whatever juices and honey were in this cup of black radish, like that's what you had to drink and that would make your cold go away. And so they're like, do that for like 3 or 4 days and you'll feel better. Like, you have to do black radish, which isn't like a tea per se. It's not like something that you would steep in water, but it is this kind of...
It's an infusion. I think that counts.
It's yeah, it is like an it's this infusion. So that's what we did. We went to the market and found some black radish. And
by the fourth day, how did you feel about this?
Well, this I did medicine. Feel better. So I was, you know, I wasn't going to... I wasn't going to knock. I was like, hey, that, you know, that it's working, so...
Did you go know. Back to it after, is my question. Is this something you said,
You know, yeah, it's definitely something that I used while I was in Ukraine. Because, you know, when you go into, like, a Ukrainian pharmacy, like, I wouldn't know the first thing to buy for my cold. Like, here I'd be like, yeah, I probably just need a little bit of this or a little of that. Or, you know, just take a little Robitussin and I'll be fine. You go into a Ukrainian pharmacy and you're like, I don't, what's the equivalent of Robitussin? I literally had to look up hydrogen peroxide for what they called it in Ukraine so that I could buy that when I went to the pharmacy because I wasn't sure. Like, they don't teach you that in Ukrainian school on Saturdays. So, yeah, I really relied on folk remedies when I was sick in Ukraine because I found them to be effective. And I found them, I felt like, well, also because of what I was doing, I was, you know, collecting folk songs from old ladies. And so if you're ever sick around an old lady in Ukraine, they're going to hook you up with all of their remedies and they know exactly how to fix you up. And so, and you can't tell them no. And so you end up, that's how I got well when I was in Ukraine. I drank a lot of mixtures created by old women.
But I still don't know if we get to the question of like common ones, which we
yeah, I don't know. I mean, I always turn to the black radish because that was the one that showed up for me the most, actually.
Well, that's neat. I think I've seen the most common plant that's just really culturally important is the bilberry plant, which is related to what we know as blueberry. But, you know, mixtures of bilberry leaves and even some of the dried fruit, lemon balm, raspberry leaves, yarrow, strawberry, rose hips, wild thyme, red clovers, all these sort of things that if you were to really take a look at the ecosystem, you would then understand how deeply connected personal health is to the ecosystem as well, through teas and other things, other foods.
I'm guessing the bilberry tasted better than the radish, but I don't know. What do you think?
Well, the radish had a bunch of honey in it, so it really just tasted like honey. So it was fine.
Fair enough. So take me through, for those of us, which I imagine is a lot of us, can you kind of take us through a day that each of you spent, you know, like what a typical day would look like and what the life was kind of like? Give us a little snapshot of what Herzl life is like in the Carpathians.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, well, I was there during the holiday season, so I was there at a special... I was there from Christmas until Epiphany. So in Ukraine, that's like... I was there actually from Christmas Eve, so that's January 6th through January 19th. And so for that holiday season, that is not a typical day. There's nothing typical about that season. So, there's perpetual Christmas caroling going on. There's like these groups of men that are called parties that go around and go caroling from every house. And there's like perpetual feasts that go on. So there's nothing typical about that season. So when I was in the Carpathians, there's just lots of food and lots of songs and that. But then there's these beautiful quiet moments too, like. It was late, and they go caroling to like 12 o'clock at night, and people still let them into their houses at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. And I remember sitting, and another thing that they do is they'll put candles out at the cemetery. And so they were kind of a little bit further down the mountain, but you could still hear the songs coming up the mountain. And so like the cemetery was between us and them. So you had all of these lit candles in the cemetery, creating this beautiful light. And you could hear them singing further down the mountain, and the music was carrying up the hill. And it wasn't too cold. It was a particularly mild winter. And it was just... And we actually were sitting outside drinking tea, because it was... I mean, it was chilly, because it was winter, but it wasn't bitter cold. And just enjoying this moment of quiet, because, you know, most of the house had already gone to bed, because it was so late. But there are these guys down the mountain singing, and there's this candlelight and this mountain air, and it was just clean and crisp and just beautiful. And I know, Nina, you had lots of moments of music, too, when you were there, but that they're not tea moments, but they are these little kind of postcards when you're up there that are just lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely... reinforce a lot of what Nadia was saying. I think the typical day, so I spent a full year there as well as a full summer, like a year and a half total. And I would say the typical days are very much invested in community. So I would say it's very rare that a person like sits in their house all day and doesn't interact with someone. Which I feel is more common. It can be more common here. But, you know, these villages are not big. And so people know their neighbors. People know if someone's cow is in the wrong place. And, you know, they'll call them up and be like, hey, your cow is across the river. Can you go get your cow? So there is just sort of this interconnected nature where people are going out. They're milking their cows. They're making sure they're fermenting. They're preparing food for folks. If tourists are in the region, they may be hosting them and telling them where to go and, you know, providing hikes. You know, you may work for a park service, so that might be where you go. That's your day job and you come home. So, I mean, it's pretty similar. You know, people go to work, but I'd say their work is slightly different. It's more integrated with their environment. And there are moments where, you know, there are times where I would fall asleep and I'd have my window open and I would hear like an accordion playing in the distance or like a violin playing in the distance. And, you know, someone had like, they're hanging out and they're singing and they're just playing music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, to bring this kind of around to tea culture, I'm trying to think, you know, for your typical day, like tourism is a very big part of the industry in the Carpathians, because, you know, people will go there to you know, it's like, oh, I got to go to the mountains to, you know, get better, or just to, you know, get my lungs filled with mountain air, or, you know, just to go see the... just go see the sights, go look at the mountains. And so, you know, hutsos very often will have, you know, it's kind of like they were doing Airbnb before Airbnb was around. And so they have like rooms of their house that they'll let or rent out to people. And when you rent out a room to people, you kind of also, it's kind of like a bed and breakfast. You need to provide them a meal. And so, you know, you get up in the morning and, you know, there's Pasha, your, for lack of a better word, your landlady who's made you breakfast, and it might be blini, it might be, who knows, like, it's always something, like, more decadent than you have ever expected. But there's always tea involved, because the Ukrainians are not a water-drinking culture. Like, I drink a lot of water, because I like to stay hydrated, and I always had to provide my own, because, like, just... like asking just for like a glass of water always seemed like a very odd thing. Like they will drink teas, they will boil all kinds of berries and like make their own juices. They, well, that's not really a juice. It's usually called uzvad or kompot or something like that, which is basically like berries boiled. And so you have like this, for lack of a better word, like a kompot that you would, you know, that you would be able to drink. And, sometimes they would have coffee, but I didn't find coffee's is not predominant. Tea is your more predominant thing. So you would, you know, you have your morning meal with your landlady, and then do whatever you need to do. Like in Nina's, in my case, if we were doing our research, sometimes we would stay home and write. I would, you know, transcribe songs or whatever, or we would go out into the field and do what we need to do, because that's what we were there to do, is research. And then when we come back in the evening, if we would have our meals at our, at the home or out somewhere, those again were always accompanied with some kind of warm drink of some kind, whether it's, I mean, one of the things that I love drinking in Ukraine was hawthorn berry tea, which they called it in Ukraine, it's aplikovi, I think. It's just because I just like the way that they made it. And it literally had, you know, at the bottom there would always like be hawthorn berries, which I loved. Yeah, and so, you know, at the end of the day, you would have your tea and, you know, go out in the mountains and listen to people make music. Because that's what I was there to do, was to listen to make people make music. But Nina was there for other reasons.
Yeah, I was there for seeing how, you know, what are the impacts of... So there's a lot that's going on in the Carpathian Mountains. And so my whole focus was looking at traditional ecological knowledge in the region. So how are folks relying on their environments, and how is that a part of the culture that we see, whether it's through language, whether that's through gathering, whether that's through planting, whether that's through how they're stewarding their forests. And so those are pretty big questions. And when you think about all of the threats that are occurring in the region, so illegal logging, for example, pollution, you have immigration, folks, there are a lot of folks that will go and work in other regions and bring income in that way. And so they're supporting their family from a distance. So there's just a lot of really interesting factors to think about when you think about this region that are not uncommon in other parts of the world as well. Mm-hmm. So that was really why I was so captivated by my research, was that not just the region, but the people as well.
Yeah. And that, what Nina mentioned, is happening in other parts of Ukraine as well, where like what I call that middle generation is often Italy, cleaning houses, or often Poland, doing other work because they can make euros there and the exchange rate is so much more in their favor. And then they send those euros back. And so, like, I celebrated Easter in my father's village, which is a little further east from the Carpathians. It's still in western Ukraine. And, you know, it's Easter. It's a big holiday. You expect, like, everybody to be there. And the people who were there in that village were the very young and the very old. And those who are in that mid-range of age, like the 20, 30, even 40-year-olds, it's just like, where is everybody else? And they're like, oh, you know, they're in Poland, they're in Germany, they're in Italy. They're off making money so that they can support their family. And that is truly a collapse, because that whole middle generation then just is away from home and is in a place where they're not in a place where they can gather and do things in a more traditional way in their own homeland as they would. Because, you know, if you're going to be in Italy, you're not going to be gathering berries in the Carpathian Mountains, you know. It's just...
Wow. So I feel like you both were in the Carpathians...
in Ukraine.
2019 or 20 or...
17 to 18.
So that seems like a really long time ago when we think of what's going on with the world. So I have two questions that are probably going to be obvious questions coming up. But before I go there, I did have two other questions I wanted to ask. You mentioned tourism is a big factor in the Carpathian Mountains or in these communities. Who is the tourist population typically composed of? Is it European vacationers or is it American vacationers, or, you know, like where are a lot of these people coming from, and how do they set up these, or, you know, like how do they set up the tourism or these Airbnbs pre-Airbnb?
It's a little bit of everything. Some of them are Ukrainians from other parts of Ukraine who, you know, want to come to the mountains and get a little bit of mountain time. Some of them, I mean, I didn't see like your standard, when I was there, I didn't see very many, but I didn't go to like the skiing lodge. I mean, there are like famous skiing lodges in the Carpathians, and I'm sure there are a different kind of clientele there. So I'm not sure. I can't answer those questions because that was not where I was. you know, so I don't know if they have like more Japanese tourists there or not. But, you know, Ukraine, for people who are, you know, coming from Europe, you know, there are a lot of Polish people who come to Ukraine for the very reason that, you know, they're part of the EU, they have the euro, and that, again, that exchange rate is great. So they could go, you know, they can come to Ukraine and their money will go a lot further than it will if they stay in Poland or if they go to Italy or another EU nation. So that's, you know, there are those kinds of tourists who go, and, you know, it's very funny. Ukraine is a very kind of word of mouth kind of place, where it sounds funny to say this now, but you literally could show up in a Ukrainian village and be like, I need a place to stay. And somebody would be like, oh, you should talk to Pasha. I think her room is available. Or if she's full up, then you can go talk to Vasil. I know Vasil could help you out. And if Vasily isn't available, his son-in-law, like, down the street has some, like, everybody, like, knows everybody and is super interconnected. And there's a lot of word of mouth that happens. And then, you know, once you've stayed there, they're like, you know, next time you're here, next time you need to come here, or if you're, you know, tell your brother to come here. And there's a lot of that happens. Neen, I don't know if you have any other people that you ran into.
Yeah, so there are little websites that they have that are kind of like Airbnb that people follow. And also there are a lot of Europeans or Eastern, Ukrainians from the eastern part of Ukraine who would come. So you would hear a lot of Russian. It's also interesting to note that Hutzels speak their own language, which is Hutzel. And it's funny because folks have a hard time understanding what they're saying. And so it is funny to kind of hear this sort of conglomeration of all these different languages. And it's a really unique place in that way.
All right. I had one other question too on the front of... when you're saying water is actually not a thing, it's a lot of juices, a lot of things like that. And to my head, I'm thinking about local addictions in Davis, California, like I think Dutch Brothers and Boba Teas has become very popular, which I wouldn't really call tea because it's 99% sugar and 1% maybe water and 0.01% tea. What... is that like, so what are these drinks like? Are they because you mentioned the honey and the radish, are they very sweet? Are they somewhere in between? Like, what's the sweet factor?
Good question.
I don't think they're very sweet. It's you get to self-regulate how much sugar you want to put in via honey. And it's also interesting to note that in this region, a local and native species of bee exists called the Carpathian bee. And so there are a lot of beekeepers in the region, and they make honey, and folks will trade, you know, honey for, I don't know, a part of a pig, for example. And so you have this really cool economy that occurs on these village levels. And so honey is the main one, although I've seen sugar too. Mm-hmm. But I prefer the honey.
Yeah. And some people will sweeten their tea with jam. They'll just, like, if they have a raspberry jam or strawberry jam around, rather than putting sugar in, they'll just take a spoonful of jam and mix that in. So, yeah, but there's nothing that says that you... I mean, there's not a... Like, no one will give you a weird face if, like, somebody hands you a cup of tea and you decide not to put honey in it. And you're like, oh, I'll just drink it this way. No one's going to go, oh, that's... No honey, no sugar, no nothing.
How gauche.
Strange. Yeah, yeah. Like, no one gives you the side eye for that. They're like, okay. And they're not, you know.
So you've both described... just this amazing sense of community where the air, I mean, it just sounds magical. You have, the air is vibrant with music. People are sharing hot beverages and talking. And so let's start with the first major event, and we'll come to the most recent events. How has the pandemic affected, do you think, these communities and the community building that's so integral to this culture?
Yeah. I'm having been in Ukraine, social distance is not a thing. I can't. Yeah, that was the first thing that I thought of when people were like, well, you know, you need social distancing will be good and this and that. And I was like, I don't know how they're going to do that in Ukraine, because they don't do social. Like, I mean, I remember, like, going to the post office and doing what in the U.S. would be like a normal, you know, giving people their space and waiting in line. And someone thought I wasn't in line and just, like, cut right in front of me because I wasn't right on top of the person in front of me. She's like, oh, she's obviously not waiting in line. I thought, and when they did, I thought, okay, I'm obviously not close enough. So I really don't, I mean, I don't know how they dealt with the pandemic there. I mean, I know that people did a lot of masking, and they were very conscious about that. Whether or not they did that so much in the mountains, you know, I mean, Hutsuls are, they're very independent-minded, and I can almost see them saying, ugh, wear a mask. Like, eat a clove of garlic, it'll be fine. You're like
you just see, put some honey on a radish, right?
Right, exactly. I could see, like, that would be their response to it. But, I mean, I don't know, Nina, do you have any direct contact with people about COVID? I haven't.
Yeah, I do. I would say that they are pretty isolated. So, you know, folks like, students that were, you know, coming in from Kyiv, you know, they were pretty mindful. I think the hardest part was getting access to vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And also, these vaccines that came out really needed to be kept at very cold temperatures. And so the lack of accessibility to good refrigeration created an issue. And so a lot vaccines were then inactivated. So even if you got vaccinated, it wasn't effective. And so I think that was more of the issue from like an infrastructure perspective. But I think in some ways they were more geographically protected because of just they're not congested like folks in a city would be, you know, living on top of one another. So I think there was a little bit of spatial protection in that way. And a lot of their work is outdoors. But folks definitely got it. And it was, you know, those that recovered, you know, were okay. And those that weren't, you know, just like here, weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So probably not huge changes in lifestyle because that was lifestyle, but, yeah. And, you know, I think about what Nadia was saying that, you had two extremes of population probably there, right? Which were probably the more vulnerable, maybe populations, just the young and the older generations. So, all right, 3 weeks ago, as of this podcast recording, Russia went into Ukraine, massive travesty and loss of life. And I guess my question is, how do sociopolitics, the wars that are going on, how is this affecting these communities? Or how do you perceive the effect that this will have on these communities moving forward? What's going on in these mountain areas?
Yeah. Well, I know one thing that they're doing is that they're accepting refugees. Also because the Carpathians are very close to the border of Romania and Slovakia. So because they're close to the border, they're, it's a place that people are coming through. Or even if they're not coming through, it's a place that people are coming to because it's safer in the mountains right now than it is to be in Kiev. So, if you have a choice of being in Kiev or being in the mountains, you're going to choose to send your family to the mountains. So there's that. But I know there's also this mobilization of accepting people that are coming in. It's not so much like, it's interesting, we in the U.S. might see that as a burden of, we have these people that we have to take care of, and Ukrainians don't see it that way. It's just like, these are our people. Like, we have to, it's kind of like they're part of their extended family in some way, and so it's like they have to, it's like your responsibility to take care of them. Yeah. So, there's that. And then I know that, I know that the men in those communities are getting ready to do what they need to do in terms of fighting if it comes to that, which is, makes me very sad that they have to think that way, but I know they are. And, when in 2014, when they had the protests in Kyiv, there were members from the Hutsul community, the Hutsuls have this kind of instrument called the trombita, which is kind of it's an alp horn. It's this really, the Swiss ones are curved, but the ones in the Carpathians are just long and straight. They're like, 6, 7, 8 feet long. They use them in the mountains for a variety of things. Most often there are different kinds of melodies that they would play that would signal different things. Like there's certain melodies that they would play that would signal that there's a funeral or a wedding or a birth. And, if you're in the mountains, it's great. Cause you hear it and you're like, okay, it's a great way to send messages. But they use it for other things too. But, when they had the protests in Kyiv, there were musicians from the mountains who went to Kyiv as part of the protests with these alp horns for these trombite, to go and play music and to, be part of that protest because it was important to them to be there because Ukrainians were battling for sovereignty. And so, I can imagine that the same kind of thing is happening right now where, the young men are going, I'm not being any good up here in the mountains. I need to go mobilize. And so I'm going to go to the barricades in Kyiv because I can make more of a difference there.
Yeah, I would echo a lot of what Nadia was saying. And also just noting that this isn't the first time in history this has happened, which is also why I think we see such a strong response in Ukraine and among Ukrainians is like this sense of how many more times is this going to happen? And even within, the Carpathian Mountains, I remember going out with a bunch of foresters and scientists from the national park. We were basically cataloging and looking at all the old growth forests. And one of the lead scientists made it a point to me So I was looking, I was kind of, you know, we were looking at something and I noticed this large sort of, kind of looked like an obelisk, the stone that kind of was jutting out. And I noticed that it formed a line if I looked further into the distance. And I was like, what is this? And he's like, that's a front line from World War II. So, I mean, these wars have been fought many times. And I think that's one thing that is evidenced by what's happening is that Ukrainians are good at mobilizing when they have to. We can make tons of jokes about other organizational deficits, but there's pretty good organization occurring, I'd say, right now.
Yeah.
Because you're looking at changes in population, right? People leaving, people coming in. And then I guess kind of the big things is the mechanisms of war causing a lot of upheaval to the land, to the pollution. I guess there's not really much to do about it except it happens. Yeah. But I guess my question is, is it just part of life or will this really create an impact long term in the communities in the tea culture that you've seen?
Well, of course, it's going to have an impact. But you know, I think also, and then the reason that I think of this. So one of my dearest respondents, if you want to use a sociological term, is a woman who was born in 1936. In central Ukraine, and she was orphaned during the Second World War, so both of her parents died, and she had a cousin who she called her brother because that was like her closest relative. But she grew up in an orphanage during the Second World War, and then really didn't have anybody kind of in her life until she got married and then had kids and grandkids and. And I called her recently. I called her on the 1st of March because, you know, it was 2 o'clock in the morning and I couldn't sleep. And I was like, okay, it's 2 o'clock in the morning here. It's 9 o'clock in the morning in Ukraine. I know she's awake. I just, you know, I need to make sure that she's okay. And so I called her and I was like, and of course, she was like, oh, Nadia, how are you doing? Like, she sounded like nothing was happening. I was like, I'm calling you. How are you doing? And she's like, oh. They're bombing, they're crazy, what is wrong with these people? And then she said something very profound. She said, you know, I've lived through this once before. I didn't think I'd have to live through this again. But we've done it before. We know how to survive it, and we'll survive through it again. And this woman, I mean, she's, what, 85 now, has mind of a steel trap, like knows a million songs, knows all these variations of these songs, like everything is in her head. Like if you sing something wrong, she's like, it goes like this. You know, like she'll catch you on it. And not only that, she's teaching all these, like anybody who comes to her house, she's like, yeah, I'll teach you. And so she's like really passing on this tradition. And so you have people like her. And so I look at her and I think, yeah, we're going to survive this thing because of people like you. Because, and she's right. She's like, you know, we've done it before. We know how to live through it. And we know how to get, because you have to remember, the Second World War was particularly brutal on Ukraine. I mean, you had Germany coming through. They had, like, the scorched earth plan. Then Germany left. Then the Soviets came through. And, I mean, it was awful on all ends. Millions of people died, mostly civilians, during the Second World War on I mean, that's why if you look at Timothy Snyder's book, who's a Yale historian, he has a book called Bloodlands, which talks about that region of Ukraine, Poland, Belarus as like the bloodiest part of World War II, because that's where most of the people died during that conflict. And so, like, and I think that's also why the Poles are getting as involved as they can in this conflict, because it's seen this. We've lived through this. We've survived this. We know what this is like. We know what's coming. We don't want to do this again.
Yeah.
And, but I, for me, that's the ray of hope is, you know, those 85-year-old women who are like, yeah, we'll come through on the other end. And you know, and they are the bearers of that culture. They're the ones who, you know, like Nina has this great story about making tea and putting tea in a hemp bag and like smooshing it all up. It's like they're the ones who have that knowledge, and they'll make it through this conflict and they'll pass it on to other people.
Which means, I think, as a extension of what Nadia's saying, is like they're still going to be drinking tea. Like, as go away, because that's what we do, you know, like it's part of surviving. And that tea also is part of healing as well.
Yeah, I think I had the wrong perspective there. Based on what you just said, I wonder if these communities aren't so strong because of the hardship and adversity. And maybe that's what makes them stronger.
Yeah, I mean, not that we're asking for extra problems. We really aren't. Like, no, we would like less problems in Ukraine, but they've been through it. It's actually interesting. There was a photo in the New York Times, you know, because it was where a bunch of civilians got shelled. And because in Ukraine there's all these monuments to the Second World War, and some civilian died, of course, but it's like where that shelling happened, it's just this, it's such an ironic photo, because it's like you see the civilians and you see people trying to help them, but just like in the corner of this photo is this World War II monument, and you know it's a World War II monument because they all kind of look the same in Ukraine. And you know, it's just like, for me, the poignancy of that photograph is just like, and I'm sure the New York Times photographer, I mean, she was in the middle of shelling and bombing and just kind of snapped this photo. And I thought, for me, that photo is extraordinary just because of the placement of everything within that photo. And it's just very, it's very prescient. It's like, yeah, we've been there before. And it's also interesting because it's one of the things that people are asking for. And they're, you know, it's like we need oatmeal, we need dry goods, we need this, this, and this. And then on the list, chai, we need tea. It's like, yeah, we still need tea.
Well, I think that is a perfect note to put this, to end this podcast. It is such a pleasure. I really am so grateful for Nina and Nadia to be able to come here and talk to us about a new perspective of tea culture. And I'm really grateful for you to make it on the show. I think we might have a real special piece to this podcast as well. I think Nadia has some music that we might add that I will not use my kind of in the can music. And I think we'll be really kind of I'm excited. I'm going to be excited to hear it. So again, thank you so much. I think we'll have a video too, Nina, where you'll be talking about the hemp bag and that. So thank you so much for making this podcast. Thanks for sharing this rich culture. It's really neat to see how tea brings us all together, no matter where you are in the world.